This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. If you were to watch TV talk shows, attend some 12-step recovery groups, and then spend a few days in the criminal courts, you'd find some interesting inconsistencies in how Americans deal with victimization and accountability, writes Wendy Kaminer. She says the recovery movement, where practically everyone is the victim of a dysfunctional family, teaches empathy and understanding for victims. But in the criminal justice system, if you argue that a person's crime is related to their having suffered abuse as a child, you'll be dismissed as a bleeding heart liberal. Unless, of course, the person on trial becomes a celebrity like Lorena Bobbitt or the Menendez brothers. Wendy Kaminer explores these contradictions in her new book, It's All the Rage, Crime and Culture. Her previous book, I'm Dysfunctional, You're Dysfunctional, critiqued the recovery movement. Kaminer is a social critic and a former public defender. I asked her if she thinks American ideas about victimization are heading in two different directions at the same time.
I think that that's true. That people tend to apply lenient standards to themselves in their 12-step groups or on the talk shows or in the context of the recovery movement or the therapeutic culture. And we want to apply very strict, absolute standards of accountability to the great majority of people who are caught up in the criminal justice system. In the world of recovery, life is a process in discovering yourself or simply reinventing yourself. In the world of recovery, there is always a second act. In the world of the criminal courts, particularly for people who are accused of capital crimes, there are no excuses. There is no possibility for redemption or rehabilitation on this earth. And these contradictions are especially striking when you look at the histories of people on death row. They have histories of abuse and deprivation that would overwhelm the talk shows. And whether or not you believe that their histories excuse their crimes, and I don't think I would say that the histories excuse their crimes, but they certainly mitigate them in some way, or at least they should mitigate their sentences.
Are there certain lessons that we've learned through the recovery movement that you think we should be applying in the criminal justice system?
Terry, that's a hard question for me. I've been so critical of the recovery movement, it pains me in some way to think that we might have gleaned something good from it. But I would have to say that an awareness of child abuse and of the deleterious effects of child abuse could be useful to us in the criminal justice system, particularly when we consider the histories of people on death row. And it's interesting to me. One of the reasons I think that we're so confused about justice and accountability is that we don't know how to punish people who are essentially guilty victims. That's what Lorena Bobbitt was, for example. She was a guilty victim. And we want to think of victims as being innocent. You know, we have innocent victims. We're not supposed to have guilty victims. And that confuses us. We tend to forget that victimization does not bring out the best in people. Victimization often makes people cruel. It often turns them into victimizers.
What's your interpretation of how the juries at the Bobbitt and the Menendez trials took into account the alleged victimization of the people on trial?
I think that the alleged victimization of the people on trial was pivotal in both those cases. In the Bobbitt case, in some ways, I think that the jurors may have felt that there was a kind of rough justice being dealt out here. I think that the jury disbelieved her husband's testimony when he denied raping her, so they believed that she had been raped. And it was almost as if he had been acquitted, and I can understand that it would seem fair to people that she would be acquitted as well. I think that some of the jurors, at least, also believed the claim of temporary insanity, the irresistible impulse defense. I think it was also pivotal in the Menendez case. I think that if a number of jurors had not believed the claim of abuse, then both those young men would have been convicted of murder. I heard one juror in the—I can't remember if she was on Eric or Lyle Menendez Hazel Thornton, who is seemed a very, you know, an intelligent, articulate woman, talking about her feelings in the case. She was one of the people who wanted to convict of manslaughter instead of murder because she deeply believed the story of abuse. She saw these young men as the victims of their parents. And most of all, what was most striking to me is that she didn't see them as a threat to society. I asked her if she had been frightened of the defendants in this case. And she said, no, I didn't think that if I was in a room with them, they would do anything to me. And I think that was also important in all of these cases. I think that's important in the way people think about the Bobbitt case, the Menendez case, and the Simpson case as well, that these were domestic crimes, and none of these people seemed like public menaces. They didn't seem like the kind of people who would take a semi-automatic rifle and shoot up a shopping mall or a commuter train like Colin Ferguson.
Do you think that the themes you're writing about, the different idea of accountability in the recovery movement and in the legal justice system, come into play in the O.J. Simpson trial?
No, I don't, because O.J. Simpson is claiming that he's innocent. This is not a case in which the defendant is saying, I did it, but I had a good excuse. I was abused. I was a battered husband. She drove me to it. I had an irresistible impulse. I was acting out of some kind of rage that I couldn't control. This is a case in which the defendant is simply saying, I didn't do it.
It's interesting, you know, on the one hand, you've said that you think our culture is starting to glorify victimhood, and that's a bad thing. And at the same time, you think that if somebody is both a victim and a perpetrator, that the fact that they've been victimized should be taken into account when they're sentenced. Are those two statements contradictory at all?
I don't think they are. I have been a strong critic of this cult of victimization, and I think I remain one. But to criticize the celebration of victimization is not to say that there are no victims in this world. One of the dangers of this pervasive sense of victimhood is that it makes it very difficult for us to make judgments about who really has been victimized, who hasn't been victimized, and how should we respond to people's claims of victimization. I think one of our problems is that we have no consensus today on who is and who is not a victim. We have a lot of people competing for the status of victim because there are a lot of benefits that go with it. We have a therapeutic culture that says to us, your feelings are what determine your reality. If you feel victimized, then you have been victimized. So I think our discussion of victimhood is very complicated, and that makes it hard to conduct on talk shows, in the media in general, because people want you to say, well, yes, you're sort of either for victimization or you're against victimization. You're either a critic of this celebration of victimization, or you believe that everyone has been victimized and that everybody's claim of victimization has to be taken on its own terms. And I don't believe that. I think we have to try to come together and make some relatively objective assessment about what it means to be victimized and how we deal with victimization.
Social critic Wendy Kaminer is my guest. Her new book is called It's All the Rage, Crime and Culture. You were a public defender in Brooklyn in the late 1970s. Mm-hmm. How did your experiences as a public defender figure into the arguments you make in your new book?
If you have any firsthand experience with the criminal justice system, I think it is very difficult to support capital punishment because you know how arbitrary the system is. And people really, even people who support the death penalty, they know deep down that the criminal courts don't really work very well. There's so much dissonance in support for the death penalty. There's so much pervasive anti-government feeling out there right now, and yet people who mistrust their government, people who don't trust their government to deliver the mail, are willing to trust the government with the power to select people to die. That's quite striking. There's no way to rationalize that. You can only explain it by looking at people's fear and fury and frustration about violent crime.
One of the things you look at is what makes people change and what are the different schools of thought now behind how to get people to change. Mm-hmm. And you identify two pretty opposing schools of thought. You call one, of course, recovery, as in the recovery movement, as embodied, say, by John Bradshaw. And the other you call virtue talk, as embodied by William Bennett, the former drug czar and former Secretary of Education and editor of the Book of Virtues. What's the difference between virtue talk and the recovery approach to change?
People in the recovery movement would say that adults can be redeemed, changed, rehabilitated. And of course, most of the consumers of 12-step books and the 12-step movement are adults. Virtue theorists, people like William Bennett, are focused on inculcating virtue in children because they tend to believe that once you're into adulthood, it's too late, that virtue has to be bred into people early on. And that's why William Bennett comes out with his Book of Virtues, which is stories for young children. You can see this tendency to give up on people when they're out of childhood, particularly clearly in the criminal justice system. You can certainly see it in our attitudes towards juvenile offenders. We want to give up on people very early these days. We want to treat 12-year-old juvenile offenders as adults. So I think that's one important difference between the recovery movement and virtue talk. I think another important difference is that they have very different values. The recovery movement values self-expression above all. Virtue theorists value self-control above all. And in some ways, self-control is a primary vice for people like John Bradshaw, or it is a symptom of the disease. Self-control is one of the symptoms of codependency. So in the recovery movement, self-control is pathologized. Among virtue theorists, it is exalted.
One of the really big issues now in the recovery movement and in the justice system is drugs. In the recovery movement, it's about how to stop doing it on a personal level, you know, how to get yourself to stop and to form a life without drugs. In the justice system, it's, of course, how to punish people who have been using or selling drugs. Do you think that the two approaches are going at it from totally different worldviews?
Yes, Terry, especially when you put it that way, it makes the opposing worldviews very clear. In the recovery movement, drug use is considered a disease, a disability. In the context of the criminal justice system, it is more like a sin. It's something that we punish. It's not something that we treat. I tend to think that we might be better off treating it more and punishing it less from a purely pragmatic perspective. I think that we need much more drug treatment in prisons and that we need drug treatment or drug abstinence programs for people out of prison who are on probation or parole.
If we're going into these two opposite directions at the same time, what do you think explains it? Why American society, on the one hand, should be saying stricter penalties for drug offenders and at the same time truly trying to understand what makes somebody an addict and how can we help them overcome it? How can they help themselves overcome it?
In part, you can explain it by saying that American society is not a monolith.
Mm-hmm. That these are different people.
Yes. In many cases, these are simply different people. Mm-hmm. That's the easy explanation. The harder explanation is that many of us are capable of believing two contradictory things at the same time. Or we apply double standards.
To ourselves and to others.
That's right. We do this all the time. And so we are sympathetic to people who have drug problems, who we can identify with in some ways, who we don't feel threatened by. And we have no sympathy for the people that we don't identify with and do feel threatened by.
Wendy Kaminer, her new book is called It's All the Rage, Crime and Culture. This is Fresh Air.